I'm Sarah Cahill with you every Sunday evening here on KALW. And with me on the phone now is pianist, writer Jack Cole. Are you there?
I am, Sarah. Great.
Thank you so much for staying up late there in New York.
Well, it's a privilege to stay up late to get a chance to speak with you and the other side of the country.
Thank you. You have a fascinating book out, a book of essays called Bone Over Ivory, Essays from a Standing Pianist. It's a book of essays about music, but it's not standard musicology or explicitly a book about playing the piano, but it's more about how being a pianist gets integrated and sort of ingrained into our everyday life. Is that true?
It is. I started as a pianist, like many of us, going through graduate school and perhaps anticipating being the kind of pianist I fantasized about in the practice room, and that didn't quite play out, and yet I didn't want to leave the field. And so as I became more and more the journeyman pianist, even a hack, even though people hate it when I use that term for myself, I kind of stand by that sometimes because I find myself accepting work that I never dreamed that I would do at times, and yet without the stress of some of the worry of working to recreate something perfect from an ostensible masterwork, I started to be able to let my mind drift and see things and recall things that I was then able to put in my journal more and more, and it yielded a book of essays.
Yeah, and if we're completely honest, some of the pianists who have achieved great success are not necessarily the ones we have the most respect for.
I suspect that may be true.
It doesn't always have to do with great, you know, great sensitivity and subtlety and all the things that we value in playing the piano, maybe.
Right. I don't know if it's because people that we respect have to sacrifice so much in terms of keeping up the standard, or does it demand a kind of focus that I don't have, where, because, as I mentioned, my mind would rove. I don't know the answer.
But
it has been a blessing, I must say, to have my mind wander to a certain extent, because I could not have been given a better set of metaphors than the piano gave in all those years of practicing.
You have a really interesting passage in, I think, the last essay in the book, where you talk about what you would say to conservatory graduates and young pianists, and you say, "Do enough of you subject music, and it's capital M, both new and old, popular and canonical, sacred and profane, not so much to a trial by market in relation to your own efforts as practitioners, but music, capital M, to a trial of yourselves, to a trial of you." And I take that to mean that it's not, as we're talking about, it's not necessarily being a pianist as a marketable thing, but pursuit, but really your relationship to music that's very deep and profound. Is that right?
Well, thank you, Sarah. I guess, in a way, because that essay is paraphrasing, at least by title, Emerson's Divinity School address.
Yes, and he says it's not about organized religion. It's about your own relationship with God, your private relationship. And so you're maybe transposing it to music rather than God. Is that right?
Exactly. And then hence I had the parody title of the conservatory school address as the title of that essay.
Right.
Because, yes, we all are presented with these ostensible masterworks that I think are genuinely masterworks, but at the same time, Emerson has that phrase that we have to bring all texts to judgment. And I wonder if sometimes, as much as we practice and analyze music, if we are altogether sincere sometimes when we take on the preservation of canonical pieces and even new music sometimes without really knowing if we're playing it from our own motivation. And I know that I'm guilty of that and have been guilty of that. And so I think that essay is in part a warning to tell my former self and any students that I would ever get a chance to speak to not to feel guilty if they have that question.
Yeah, yeah. We should mention it's from the Pochtog Press, and your last name is spelled K-O-H-L, Jack Cole, Bone Over Ivory, Essays from a Standing Pianist. And where can people find this book?
The book would be on all the standard online outlets like Amazon or Barnes & Noble.
Uh-huh, so K-O-H-L is your last name. And what is the Pochtog Press?
The Pauktog Press is a place like Coco Voco, where Queequeg of Moby Dick comes from. It's down on any map so long as you don't go looking for it.
Ah, great.
It is a place name on Long Island that I created.
Oh, I see. That's wonderful. Mm-hmm. You are, one might say, a transcendentalist. You've written about Ralph Waldo Emerson. Your last book was called That Iron String, which is from an Emerson quote, "Trust thyself, every heart vibrates to that iron string," but of course also a reference to a piano string. And you've written about Henry David Thoreau, and you write declamatory sentences very similar to those of Emerson, like sort of aphoristic almost. And I wonder if there's a story that he would keep a notebook and write down those sentences and then combine them in an essay. Do you something similar?
I do. Thank you, Sarah. Yes, Emerson and Thoreau are some of the great, as well as other transcendentalists, but particularly Emerson and Thoreau, the great, great journal keepers. Mm. And they took it to an extent that they would index their journals by subject headings, and Emerson called his journal his savings banks, and then he would go back to them and combine them and sometimes rework them in infinite permutations. Yes, and frankly, this book, Bone Over Ivory, was an experiment not so much in aping Emerson's style, but perhaps assigning myself the task of quarrying from my journal and looking at all sorts of headings over the years, whether it might be the sustaining pedal or piano lid or broken keys, and then putting them under headings and trying to work them into cogent essays.
And the essays were written for this book, or were they written for some other purpose?
They were written individually over time, and they appeared sometimes on different websites. And then, however, while I was doing them, I was conscious that there was a thread in this set of essays, and I felt they had to be brought together in this book.
Yeah. You have a wonderful essay called A Transcendentalist Love Story, Sonata Form, which tells a love story in sonata form, so there's a exposition, development, and recapitulation, but not really a recapitulation, and it also includes Emerson's house and quotes from him and The Great Gatsby and Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue. But it's such a wonderful idea that music is integrated into life, because of course you do spend, I mean, you yourself have spent so many hours at the piano, and it's just ingrained in a way into our consciousness, so that yes, when you see a number 109 or 127 or 118, you think immediately of late Beethoven or Brahms intermezzos, that the number 109 has a meaning that other numbers might not. Is that right?
Yes, and I'm glad you've mentioned that essay. I don't know how many people or musicians have this experience, but oftentimes aestheticians will argue that a work of art really can never be applicable to life or outside of its own appreciation, but oftentimes I find myself importing musical forms or thinking that I should feel that certain aspects of life will answer a form, and that was a particular true story that I told, where I thought for sure that I was only at the end of the exposition, and that surely life was going to put me back to the front of the sonata, and then the context of the exposition would run again. And what I learned was that I had forced a form, a sonata form, a very 18th century sense of the form, onto this love story in my own life, and then learned that that was not the form, and I had to grapple with what form was it then. And that's what that essay really turned into.
Yeah, yeah. And interesting that you start the whole book with the list. I mean, you have a few sonata forms that are very different. Like you start with the Liszt sonata and then the Concord sonata of Charles Ives, which are such non-traditional sonata forms.
True, really. Yes. Maybe somehow I was very chaotic that Liszt and Ives grant themselves, or the freedom that they grant themselves, and then moving toward the middle of the book where I try to examine how I might apply myself to more traditional forms, and then, as you mentioned with the last essay, perhaps arguing that we have to really bring to bear our own judgment on all of those forms and perhaps impose a form of our own, even onto our own lives from the study of music.
Yeah, so even though the essays are individual, there's a cohesiveness from beginning to end. In many of the, there are various threads going through it that bring it all together.
I hope that people do see that. Yeah, I did try to plan a cyclic aspect to the book so that ultimately, I hope that maybe even one could pick the book up at different points and also read the book out of order and still get, like in reading an Emerson essay, some value from it.
Right. What are you playing on the piano now?
Mainly, I work as a rehearsal pianist and play for singers and in musical theater pits for Broadway kind of scenarios. And that's, as I mentioned, what led to the taking of notes from the piano from a different perspective. I was such a rigid practicer, realizing Beethoven or Liszt or Ives, and with sweat on my brow, always hoping I did justice by them, that I didn't realize the world that would open up to me if I was still playing, and in a little bit more of a relaxed scenario. I hope no one in the theater world will take exception to the notice. I relax more when I do that, but it has allowed me to think more about all.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi. Something happened with the phone.
Oh, dear. Yeah. Okay.
But you said to think more. What was the end of that sentence?
Oh, I just said that somehow being more of a practical player, just going out on whatever jobs I find in terms of rehearsal playing and audition playing, has allowed me to... Well, Thoreau has an idea that often if one has to use their knowledge all the time, one doesn't have a chance then to grow.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that by being able to relax a little bit but still being able to play, I've been able really to examine my playing more because I'll be sent out to jobs where I can't prepare. I just have to read what's on the spot or endure playing something 900 times during a dance rehearsal. And yet somehow, metaphorically, I've filled my journal sometimes more with that than the decades I sat in the practice room.
It's wonderful to work with singers and get that sense of the breath, and some of that music is so incredibly difficult for the pianist because, I mean, it's like you're being the whole orchestra, right, in
right,
many cases.
Yes.
And, I mean, things like Schubert Lieder, where it's just as hard as one of his sonatas.
Absolutely, and sometimes, as you know, Sarah, the realizations for a reduction from an orchestra part or a musical theater score, it's very ill-conceived for the piano, and that can present all sorts of challenges.
Yes. I hope they don't call you their accompanist.
Sometimes, but I've learned also to take that in metaphorical stride and to try to make something out of that every time I hear phrases like that.
One of my favorite essays in this book is, of course, in praise of wrong notes in performance, and you write, "The wrong note discovered honestly is the best note." You call it principle over sequence. Can you describe this idea of wrong notes?
Sure. I think, obviously, we all in a recital aim to hit the right notes, and no one feels creditable if they haven't prepared and the notes are sloppy because of laziness. But I have found that sometimes I've hit some real, real clinkers in my life while I was earnestly, totally prepared and trying not to hit them. And somehow, because we come into a recital with the music memorized, I think it metaphorically stands for the old romantic notion that we come into life, even as babies, almost with the mystery of the universe already in our minds. And I think the parallel with a pianist is there, that even if we hit a wrong note, we somehow know the beginning and the end anyway. And it's as if, because we know the promise of the piece, because we have it memorized, it's not that we haven't hit the wrong note, but somehow it doesn't seem to jar one if you know that you're involved in something that you've internalized, just like the greater aspects of life. If you don't feel that you're in a sequence, but you know the piece by heart, it becomes something that is a metaphorical opportunity rather than a wrong note.
Yeah, that's a wonderful, wonderful way to think. And, of course, there are many of our favorite recordings by people like Richter and Schnabel and others where they hit wrong notes, which we treasure much more than note-perfect performances by other pianists.
Well said. And when we hear those recordings, we even come to look for them and cherish those notes on the recording.
Yes.
And
yes.
I think in part, I appreciate your question, because maybe that in part is what I was meditating, that somehow that wrong note becomes an opportunity for us to reconcile it to the score.
Right. Right. It's a wonderful essay, and this is just a wonderful book. So again, it's Bone Over Ivory, essays from a... Why essays from a standing pianist? Did I miss something?
No, I don't think you missed anything. People have asked me. I think because mainly the book is about ideas that have come to me when I'm not at the bench or on the bench.
That makes sense.
Even there have been times in my life where I thought, oh, darn, the piano's put me in this terrible bind professionally. I'm, you know, hardly finding any work at this period. And yet I've never been able to escape it. In other words, I'm still thinking about all the things it has given me metaphorically so that even when I'm a standing pianist, in other words, one who's not playing, it still is there all the time.
Yeah. And you also have a website, JacksonCohl.com, and that's Jackson, KOHL.com. And people can find the book there as well as the usual places, as you say.
Yes.
We're going to listen to a recording of the Concord Sonata by Charles Ives, so maybe you can tell us a little about it and sort of introduce it. You have a great essay which is in this book, on page 7. You say, "This work has been as a dorsal fin in my existence since I was in my mid-teens, serving midway between the pectoral influences of Ralph Waldo Emerson on one side, through his journals and published essays, and Franz Liszt on the other, principally through his sonata in B minor." Ives names the four movements after four transcendentalist writers, Emerson, Thoreau, the Alcotts, Thoreau and...
I'm sorry, so we had... I think you got them. Oh, Emerson, then we have... Hawthorne,
the Alcotts, and Thoreau. I just got confused about the order for a second. Yes, Hawthorne. And your introduction to this sonata was through the Ives book, right? Essays Before Sonata.
That's right. In fact, when I was a child, the Easter Bunny left that book for me. And rather than, I guess, leave me candy for some reason, I don't know how the Easter Bunny knew, but I was left a copy of that book as a child. And I was stunned by the book because it prints the score on the opposite page of the text. And in part, the essay is a meditation on just the sheer impact that the look of the score can have. Because I was a child at that time, and I was only playing out of maybe John Thompson learning books.
Oh.
And yet the score was such that it made an impression on me just from the sheer font to the appearance of the engraving of the music. And I think, in part, that is something that meditates over to Emerson's style, which is, in fact, it was Samuel Barber who said that he thought you could cut up the Concord Sonata and put it in all different order and it would sound the same.
Huh.
And that, of course, sounds like a tremendous diatribe. However, I don't know that Ives would object because, like Emerson, whose prose is oftentimes said to be an army all officers, I find the music of the Concord Sonata to be the same. It's an experiment in absolute density, where the music is so dense, there's no transitional material, and if people can surrender themselves to it, I think they might find there's quite something to it. What recording are you going to listen to?
Marc-André Hamelin. But what is your favorite recording?
Gosh, let's see. That's a great one.
Yeah.
There's also one by Robert Shannon that I listened to.
Okay.
That I thought was really, really fine when I was in graduate school, and I think that was the one that I consulted the most. Of course, there are some fragmentary examples of Ives himself playing the piece.
Right, and I love the original John Kirkpatrick, where he spent, 15 years learning the piece and then finally performed it and devoted much of his life to it. And also interesting that it goes from, we're used to going from simplicity to complexity in a piece of music. And this starts out the first page, I think, is the densest and most complex in the piece, right?
Well,
and then
it
gradually sort of empties out later on in the piece.
Yes, but the Alcott's movement, the third movement, in a way, is that if the exposition is buried in the middle.
Mm.
So that's the way I've always heard the piece, that you somehow are thrown into the development and thrown into this wild scherzo of the Hawthorne. And then, if you've done your duty, you get to the exposition.
Well, let's listen to it. And
okay.
Emerson, Hawthorne, the Alcotts, and Thoreau. Thank you so much, Jack, for speaking tonight, and congratulations on your new book. It's really wonderful, Bone Over Ivory, Essays from a Standing Pianist.
Thank you, Sarah.
Yeah, thank you.